this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline for the cover story, Fabrics of the Future. Researchers at NC State University's College of Textiles use innovations like Pyroman to develop products that could redefine North Carolina's role in the textiles industry. And that coverage, that headline is on the front page. The actual article begins inside with a second headline. Tomorrow's textiles, NCSU researchers are designing new materials for commercialization. And this article is written by Dawn Wallace. The laboratories at NC State University's College of Textiles are full of rapidly spreading infections, fires, and threats of terror. Workers in those labs like it that way. The college, for decades known as one of the nation's top institutions for innovation in the textiles industry, is doing far more than turning out the best in fabrics and fashion designers. Researchers are developing clothing that keeps California firefighters safer from burning flames, medical patches that deliver fast-acting pharmaceuticals to cancer patients, and protective gear for soldiers in the Middle East who rely on their camouflage to keep them out of harm's way. As traditional manufacturing has moved overseas and production has become automated and digitized, high-tech products like these could bring new life to an industry that North Carolina has seen wither away over the past several decades. Billions of dollars have disappeared from the state's economy in the past three decades. Thousands of jobs are gone, and municipalities have struggled to find a good replacement for the idle mills. Walking through the hallways of the College of Textiles in Raleigh, one may wonder if the researchers and students, a large portion of whom are from foreign countries, have taken it upon themselves to revive the textile industry and jumpstart the manufacturing jobs machine. The Revival. Each year, the College of Textiles, whose multiple departments now fall into two categories, retail and research, receives millions of dollars from industry partners to develop new materials. The Nonwovens Institute within the college is home to some of the world's leading research on fiber modification, application, and performance, and has spent about $35 million in the past 14 years on the development of new materials. Industry funding, which increased 6% last year, comes primarily from memberships in the Nonwovens Institute, around 65 global partners and textile companies with headquarters or operations in North Carolina pay $50,000 per year for the privilege of partnering with the college. These funds fuel the innovation of materials in the labs, which are vetted and carried through to commercialization, serving more than 200 ready and waiting industry customers. Nonwovens are growing at a rate of 4 to 6% annually, and North Carolina is and has been the hub for nonwovens manufacturing, says Benham Pordehimi, Associate Dean for Industry Research and Extension and Director of the Nonwovens Institute. We have never been as busy as we are. The goal, commercialization. Materials coming out of the College of Textiles labs are segmented by industry, such as medical and hygiene, filtration, automotive, wipes, building and industrial, and emerging durables. They include nonwoven materials, fibers, and polymers. Some feature additives or coatings that address specific needs. At any given time, the College of Textiles has at least 200 two-year research projects at the master's level and around 100 long-term projects at the PhD level, which encompass a wide range of products and processes such as sports materials, hygienic fibers, and water filtration. Research can take several years before it can be tested or patented for commercialization. But just like any research, a project may not go anywhere and die an untimely death after using millions of dollars in government grants or private money. But as Pordehimi opines, the payoff is far greater than just dollars and cents. Not only do we help society by bringing new, really cool technologies to the marketplace, we train future leaders, says Pordehimi. Part of what we do, we have to ensure we have a sustainable human capital asset. Medical applications. Crafting a material for use in healthcare applications often begins with a single fiber that can be paired with other fibers of similar or different structure to create a surface. Fibers can even be paired with a living virus for a resulting fiber that can be used to deliver treatments. My colleague grows plant viruses, which are amazing because they are alive and harmless to humans, Purdahimi says. The viruses are hollow, and they can be filled with medicine for cancer patients. The idea is that the cancer site has a different pH, and under those conditions, the viruses release the drugs. The viruses are embedded into fibers, creating a non-woven material that allows the viruses to continue to live until deployed through a patch on a patient's skin. Although the technology has been effective as far as holding and maintaining the viruses and has been patented, there is still work to do before the material hits the medical industry. Right now, we are trying to figure out what the next step is to take the technology to market, he says. We need to be able to push the technology out so a startup company won't work. Last year, Purdahimi worked with researcher Elizabeth Laboa in a joint NCSU-UNC Department of Biomedical Engineering to develop a bandage that delivers antimicrobial, anti-inflammatory, or antibacterial medications, along with stem cells, to a wound before dissolving. The bandage was tested on pigs and mice and on a mosquito bite infected with MRSA on Laboa's leg, which healed within 3 days after topical antibiotics didn't help. Emergency responder clothing. Rushing into a burning building takes more than guts. It means trusting the fire-retardant suit meant to protect the emergency responder from flames, heat, and smoke. But trusting a professional's life to a protective material requires first testing it on a mannequin under the trademarked name Pyroman in the Textile Protection and Comfort Center, a lab within the College of Textiles. Pyroman is used to evaluate the performance of thermal protective clothing to create a realistic simulation of a flash fire condition and analyze the response of mannequin heat sensors to predict the potential tissue burn damage to the wearer of military, first responder, or industrial workwear, according to NCSU. It's shaped like a man, dressed in the clothing to be tested and placed in a robust case that researchers can blast with flames for just a few seconds at a time. Pyroman has 122 PyroCal heat sensors that allow researchers to gather data about burn sites through computer analysis, which generates a graphic report for each test. Researchers can see where the heat slipped through or determine if the material has weak points. Similarly, the lab has pyro hands and a pyro head. People are used as test subjects in another part of the center that analyzes the way liquids and gases permeate materials during strenuous activity. Military protective gear. Hiding in plain sight from the enemy on foreign terrain may be common expertise for the U.S. military, but to maintain that ability, each piece of camouflage material that comes in, whether clothing, tent canvas, or other gear, is inspected for consistency. Any discrepancy in the camouflage is considered the difference between life and death. NCSU researcher Renzo Shamey received a $685,000 government grant to create a computer that can read camouflage and compare it to the Army standard. We're trying to come up with a consistent and repeatable pass-fail methodology, he says. Someone has the job of examining each piece of camouflage for consistency and adherence to a strict standard based on color and patterns. The job requires astute attention to detail and is not free from human error. The problem is that camouflage is multicolored, he says. Measuring a single spot on the fabric can be difficult and tedious. Multiple manufacturers supply camouflage materials to the Army, and the slightest change in the manufacturing process can impact the end result. For example, changing the temperature on the roller used to push the material through the dyeing process can affect the color. The computer Shamey is developing involves both hardware and software. We do not aim to replace individuals who are doing this type of work, Shamey says. The idea is to provide them with the technology they can use to provide consistent and repeatable responses to the manufacturers. Going forward. There is little doubt that technology will continue to replace workers in certain fields and offer new opportunities in others. And while that keeps CEOs and directors of companies awake at night, worried about their stock performance and quarterly earnings call, innovation, productivity, and efficiency remain the central theme of a company's existence. From conversations with researchers, professors, and administrators at the College of Textiles, one thing is clear. The school's success will depend on its ability to work with companies and government entities across the world and move the ball forward by commercializing products that are always better, sometimes cheaper, and globally acceptable. As Portahimi concludes, companies look at us to bring them products that don't exist today. And there are some charts and lists accompanying this article. The first one is headlined, "Where Are They Going?" The chart depicts where students from NC State University's College of Textiles go after graduation. 70% to textile companies, 13% to graduate school, 9% to non-textile jobs, and 8% still actively seeking employment. Also, the top NCSU College of Textiles research sponsors, $1.4 million, Nike, $1 million, DHS, $658,000, U.S. Army, $500,000, DTRA, Defense Threat Reduction Agency. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Rebecca Troyer. The first headline, McConnell Golf picks up Greenville Country Club. Raleigh-based McConnell Golf acquired Greenville's Brook Valley Country Club, expanding eastward by adding a ninth course under the McConnell name. John McConnell, president and CEO of McConnell Golf, said both family legacy and the rapidly growing eastern North Carolina market played a role in the transaction, which he described as a partnership between his company, the Neighborhood Homeowners Association, Brook Valley Holdings, and the Taylor family, which owned Brook Valley. The course has some history. In 1966, golfing legends Ben Hogan and Sam Snead played an exhibition match there, and former U.S. Open champions Curtis Strange and Webb Simpson both won tournaments at the course during their amateur careers. The course has hosted several Carolinas Golf Association state championships and qualifiers, in addition to being the host site for two Touchstone Energy mini tournaments. Autumn in Raleigh means the annual Pumpkin Chunkin'. Raleigh web design firm Atlantic BT hosted its sixth annual Pumpkin Chunkin' event on October 24 outside the company's office on Creedmoor Road. This year, they celebrated both the return of fall and the return of John Jordan as Atlantic BT's president and CEO. The event included a pumpkin carving contest, food from Clyde Cooper's Barbecue, beer from Big Boss Brewing Company, and of course the Pumpkin Chunkin'. Atlantic BT employees built a 10-foot machine that launched pumpkins up to 80 yards. John Karnofsky, who launched his pumpkin the farthest, was crowned Pump King. A toast to Durham's shiny new artwork. A new piece of art towers over pedestrians in Durham's CCB Plaza, dedicated to Downtown Durham Incorporated's longtime and recently retired CEO and president, Bill Kalkoff, who founded the organization in 1993 and served in the position for 20 years. The piece, crafted by Durham artist Al Frege, reflects the revitalization of downtown and features reclaimed artifacts from nearby warehouses. The base of the art resembles the Durham skyline, and the bottom of the piece reflects the old Durham. The top is a shiny chalice cup symbolizing the shiny new Durham. NCSU spinout is out to conquer stinky socks. Two NC State University College of Textiles professors designed smelly socks created by startup company Textile Sense. The socks can be infused with therapeutic scents such as jasmine and chamomile. The scent can be re-injected into the socks when it wears off. Co-founder Andre West, who has been in the apparel business for more than 30 years, created his own clothing line while at trend forecasting company Derek Healy International. Kate Annette Hitchcock, the other half of the Smelly Socks partnership, focuses her research on clothing for health and well-being and cross-cultural inspirations in fashion design. And finally, in the You Said It section, Twitter feedback on the holiday retail season. It's Halloween, but it's also beginning to look a lot like Christmas. Biz spied employees at Crabtree Valley Mall placing ornaments on Christmas trees outside McCormick & Schmick's on October 27 and tweeted out a photo. Twitter followers were as surprised as Biz to see the Christmas creep in the height of fall. Too soon, from Lisa at WRAL, Lisa Jeffries. It's not even Halloween, Jennifer Smith. Oh, come on, Crabtree, Will Thompson. And ha, LOL, ween, New Raleigh. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the A Better World page, and we start with Todd Cohen's column. Todd Cohen publishes Philanthropy, North Carolina. The headline on the column, Bankers Promote Financial Literacy. North Carolina, the 10th most populous U.S. state, ranks 37th in financial literacy, according to WalletHub, based on 12 metrics gauging knowledge, education, planning, and daily habits. To stimulate efforts to improve financial literacy, the North Carolina Bankers Association Foundation has launched the North Carolina Center for Financial Literacy. Financial education matters because no matter what career you have, what path you take, it's one of the most important parts of your life, says Jan Dillon, the center's director. The Bankers Association Foundation, the philanthropic arm of the North Carolina Bankers Association, has made financial literacy a focus for at least 21 years through Camp Challenge, a one-week residential camp it has offered to more than 9,300 middle school students each summer since 1993. Lessons are geared toward issues the students actually are thinking about, like buying a car or starting their own business, says Dillon. Using digital tablets, for example, campers can go online to find out the cost of buying a car, choose the one they want, many opt for expensive makes such as Maserati or Bugatti, use an auto loan calculator to determine the monthly cost, then compare that monthly car payment with the monthly pay they could expect to receive from the careers they hope to pursue. We're teaching students at an early age what debt really means, Dillon says. The foundation expects, by the end of the year, to launch a campaign to increase its endowment, which now totals $1.4 million, to generate enough income to cover the $175,000 annual cost of operating Camp Challenge. After operating for 20 years at a 4-H camp in Stokes County, Camp Challenge this year relocated to YMCA Camp Weaver in Greensboro, where its costs nearly doubled, causing it to reduce to 300 from 400, the total number of campers who attend 8 one-week sessions. While it is free, Camp Challenge charges a $10 application fee and covers costs through money raised in an annual fund campaign. The new Center for Financial Literacy already has convened a roundtable discussion among officials of financial services companies, state government, and others to talk about financial literacy education in the state's public schools. It is also teaming with communities and schools of Charlotte-Mecklenburg to bring a local professional basketball player to teach a credit lesson in a local middle school. Ultimately, the center wants to foster private-public partnerships that will increase opportunities for students, adults, seniors, military personnel, and veterans to learn about it, Dillon says. And in the nonprofit news, Red Cross gets gift of unclaimed cash. The National American Red Cross benefited from North Carolinians who did not claim their cash. During the North Carolina State Fair, State Treasurer Janet Cowell presented the Red Cross with a nearly $10,000 check from unclaimed property in the state. Every year, there is unclaimed property in the state. Currently, the total is about $350 million. At the fair, representatives from the treasurer's office run the North Carolina cash booth to help North Carolinians claim their property. Sometimes that money goes unclaimed and the state donates a portion, this year, to the Red Cross. Biogen IDEC funds World Biotech Tour. The Biogen IDEC Foundation granted $1.5 million to the Association of Science Technology Centers for the launch of the World Biotech Tour, a multi-year partnership between the two organizations that will increase the impact and visibility of biotechnology among youth and the general public at science centers and museums across the globe by providing hands-on learning opportunities. Biogen IDEC operates two facilities in the Research Triangle Park area and has long supported STEM and related educational programs. And now we turn to the Triangle Business Journal's reporter pages, and we start with the page of Amanda Hoyle, who covers commercial and residential real estate. The first headline, Grocery Store Wars. As Publix arrives in Cary, Harris Teeter continues to add locations. Two new grocery stores opened in Cary on October 29 that effectively launched a new grocery battle for Triangle shoppers. The Publix supermarkets chain opened its first store in all of the Triangle at the new Bradford retail and apartment community on Davis Drive. Across town, competitor Harris Teeter opened its newest store in the region at the Village Square Shopping Center on Walnut Street. Florida-based Publix is a new grocery brand to the market, having announced in 2013 plans to open its first store in the region at Bradford and confirming plans to aggressively seek additional site locations in the region. It, however, has yet to go public with its plans for a second store location in the Triangle. A development group representing Publix has proposed plans to build a new grocery-anchored retail store at the intersection of Falls of Neuse and Dunn Roads in North Raleigh, but about 2,000 neighbors from nearby communities, including Bedford, Falls River, and Wood Spring, have petitioned for the city to reject the retailer's plans based on its proximity to a residential area and the increased auto traffic it will bring. Harris Teeter has long been a grocery market leader in the Triangle, and the new Village Square grocery store is a replacement for an older, smaller store that Harris Teeter moved from near Cary Town Center Mall. Harris Teeter has nearly 40 store locations in the Triangle, and also is scheduled to open a new store location at the intersection of Creedmoor and Millbrook Roads in North Raleigh in 2015. Troubled office building gets new owner. A new, more stable owner has emerged for the 3110 Edwards Mills Road office building that has been on and off the auction block for the past 2 years. The Simpson Organization of Atlanta paid $6.7 million for the 46,100-square-foot office building in West Raleigh, according to Wake County deed records. The building has been offered in August, or had been offered in August through an auction site set up by Real Capital Markets, but it was unclear whether the Simpson Organization was the highest bidder or whether it negotiated its own deal with the seller. The three-story office building was previously owned by a group representing lenders on the building's mortgage after its developer, Raleigh-based Lichting Corporation, foreclosed on its loan. The group paid $6.88 million at a foreclosure auction in 2012, according to deed records. At that time, the West Raleigh building was only 47% occupied, but its leasing activity has improved to nearly 96% occupancy in the third quarter of 2014. It is anchored by Hutchison Law Group and the Raleigh office of Cassidy Turley. And in hospitality news, Raleigh's Concord Hospitality Planning Pipeline of New Hotels. Concord Hospitality Enterprises of Raleigh has a pipeline of new projects it says could create 800 permanent jobs. One of the projects, a 143-room Residence Inn, is in Durham and is expected to open in June 2015, but all the others are spread along the East Coast. Courtyard by Marriott in Raleigh sells for $14.5 million. A subsidiary of New York financing firm North Star Realty Finance has acquired the Courtyard by Marriott Hotel at the intersection of Interstate 440 and Wake Forest Road in Raleigh. And North Star paid $14.5 million for the 153-room hotel that opened in 1986. And finally, Aloft Hotel in Durham reaches halfway point. Construction of the new Aloft Durham Downtown Hotel has reached the midway point as the owners and developers of the project celebrated October 27 with a topping out lunch and gathering at the nearby Tobacco Road Sports Cafe. The six-story, 134-room boutique hotel is being built directly adjacent to the Durham Performing Arts Center within the American Tobacco Campus, and it is slated to open in spring 2015. And now we have the page for Lauren Onosorge, who covers technology and entrepreneurship. It's a bed, it's a couch, it's the nugget. UNC student launches casual furniture business. Meet the nugget, an orange rectangle topped with triangular cushions in the basement of the American Underground at Main in downtown Durham. Soon it will be in spare rooms and dorm rooms across the country, doubling as a bed and a couch. At least that's the goal of the UNC entrepreneur who, after winning the Moorhead Kane Scholarship, poured his own college fund into his startup, Durham-based Nugget. David Barron didn't set out to be a furniture entrepreneur. The then biology major at UNC Chapel Hill was inspired into it, or as he calls it, uninspired into it. It was those futons we had in college, he says. He assembled two in that Durham Hill dorm room, both ridiculously, insanely difficult to assemble, and both broke halfway through the year. But Barron didn't just cart it to the dumpster and forget about it. He became obsessed. It was a love-hate relationship, he says. Barron just happened to brainstorm with the son of Mark Knoll, founder of foam producer Nomaco in Zebulon. So with the help of Nomaco, he set out to make a 100% foam couch. Armed with napkin drawings of what he was looking for, he developed a real prototype, a foam-based model with washable covers that could be completely disassembled. The four-piece, $279 prototype weighs 17 pounds, and to make a bed, all you have to do is remove the triangular pillows. There are no attachments, and it can't possibly break like a futon frame, he says. Barron, who slept on one every night for 6 months, says it's going to take cash to flesh out and plans to raise up to $40,000 on Kickstarter to supplement the college fund. Frontier Communications chooses Bull City over competitors. Guess what? Durham's first, says Dennis Bloss, Frontier Communications General Manager for North Carolina. Kansas City who? Bloss, along with his CEO, Maggie Wilderotter, were in Durham October 23 to announce that the company picked Durham as its first fiber market. The first customer? American Tobacco Campus. NCSU researchers, Triangle startups likely to go on a rampage. Optimism. That's the big takeaway from the first installment of a quarterly NC State University survey measuring the outlook of Triangle entrepreneurs. Initial results show optimism for increased revenue, spending, and employment well into spring 2015. Almost 87% of the 199 Triangle Area entrepreneurs surveyed expect an increase in revenue over the next 6 months. With a quarter of the sample reporting being pre-revenue and still 87% of the folks anticipating positive increases in sales, that could mean that the nascent of pre-revenue businesses we are cultivating in the Triangle are about to sort of go on a rampage, says Jeff Pollack, Assistant Professor of Management, Innovation, and Entrepreneurship in the Poole College of Management at NC State, who developed the survey. That's probably not the technical term for it, he says. Only 4% anticipated revenue declines. Little more than 60% expected to hire new employees, with only 2.5% expecting staff increases, and 55.8% predicted an increase in domestic capital spending. Entrepreneurs did have concerns, however, with 56.7% of respondents saying growing too slowly is an issue. Economic uncertainty, came in third with 48.1%. All in all, however, it's hard to take one quarter and create a complete outlook when you have nothing to compare it to, Pollack says. The economic number is 113.67, but it doesn't mean anything without data from other quarters. That's why the next set of survey results will be even more important. We'll be able to see the trend that is happening, he says. Should the triangle post growth quarter after quarter, that's when we start to really know the wheels are turning. And finally, in a They Said It section, it's headlined, Triangle Entrepreneurs Reflect on Local Startup Climate and Opportunities. And first, we have a quote from Philip Rhodes, the founder of Fogbeam Labs. This area has the key ingredients. You have the universities, the community colleges. What this area doesn't have in terms of the West Coast is money. And from Jason Massey, founder of Sustainable Industrial Solutions. I grew up not so far from here. You didn't come to Durham. There was no activity in Durham. Now, Durham has claimed a nice spot in the startup ecosystem. And Justin Beard, founder of Snap Yeti. The community, the ecosystem is optimistic, which I think is great. And finally, Oyin Charles, founder of ArtHive Online. The startup community is very strong. Everyone is talking, there's networking, and when you're new at this, it really helps. And now we turn to the page of Jason DeBrun, who covers healthcare and biopharmaceuticals. Novartis sells flu vaccines, local plant. Swiss drug company Novartis announced it would sell its flu vaccine business, which includes the large facility in Holly Springs, for $275 million to CSL based in Australia. The sale does not come as a surprise. In April, Novartis reached a blockbuster deal with GlaxoSmithKline to sell various programs to each other. In that deal, Novartis sold most of its vaccine business to GSK, but kept its influenza vaccine separate. However, the company also announced it would look to sell that business separately. Novartis manufactures a flu vaccine called Flucivax in Holly Springs. The vaccine is made using a cell-based technology, hence the name, instead of using chicken eggs, which has been the process to make vaccines for years. CSL has more than 40 years of experience in the influenza vaccines business and operates in 27 countries with more than 13,000 employees worldwide. In addition to vaccines, CSL has established businesses in plasma-driven therapies, pharmaceuticals, antivenoms, and immunohematology. The Novartis influenza vaccines unit will be combined with CSL's subsidiary, BioCSL. In CSL, we have found not only an owner for the influenza business that shares our commitment to protecting public health, but also a strong growth platform for the business and our associates, said Joseph Jimenez, CEO of Novartis, in a statement. Until the transaction with CSL is completed, Novartis will continue to operate its influenza vaccines business and report its results under discontinuing operations. BCBSNC's ACA premiums to go up 13%. North Carolinians who buy health insurance on an individual basis, meaning those who don't buy through an employer, from Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, will see between a 13% and 19% premium rate increase on average next year. That applies to roughly 550,000 North Carolina residents who buy health insurance on the individual market from BCBSNC, the state's largest health insurer. Although BCBSNC holds a commanding market share in the individual market, those customers still represent only about 14% of the company's overall customer base. Including those who buy health insurance through an employer, BCBSNC covers more than 3.8 million North Carolinians. Individual plan designs will remain largely the same, says Patrick Getson, BCBSNC chief actuary, meaning individuals will not see major shifts to healthcare coverage copays, or deductibles. What Inc. Research plans to do with $156 million. Contract research organization Inc. Research expects to net between $135 million and $156 million from an initial public offering. Inc. is currently held by private equity groups Avista Capital Partners and affiliates of the Ontario Teachers Pension Plan, which acquired the company in 2010 for a reported $600 million. Those groups would still own a majority of the Class A shares after the public offering, though exactly how many shares has not been disclosed. Inc. plans to use appreciably all of the IPO proceeds in order to pay down part of its nearly $600 million in debt. The company has only recently turned a profit, and years of deficits have racked up debt. As a CRO, Inc. Research helps pharmaceutical companies bring new drugs to market. During drug development, pharmaceutical and biotechnology companies must test their experimental drugs in human trials. Because these trials can be cumbersome and require a lot of data crunching, there exists a large industry of researchers who conduct this work and analyze the data to report back to the drug developer. And along with that article, there's a section, Inc.'s IPO by the numbers. 8.1 million shares to be sold on the open market. 60 million common shares outstanding after the offering. $17 to $20 proposed IPO price per share. $135 million to $156 million. Net proceeds to Inc. Research after underwriter discounts and based on current plans. $851 million. Inc. Research's revenue for first 9 months of 2014. $45 million. Inc. Research's operating income for first 9 months of 2014. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the reporter page of Dawn Wallace, who covers small business personalities and Triangle trends. The first headline, DME Fuel is on the horizon. Company demos new fuel at Raleigh Expo. Dimethyl ether, DME, could be the fuel of the future, and Volvo Trucks of Greensboro has vehicles that run on it in place of diesel. Parked at the Raleigh Convention Center for the Alternative Fuels Conference and Expo last week, the blue truck demonstrated how trucks fueled by DME would run relatively the same as trucks fueled by diesel. Frank Bio, Director of Sales Development for the Specialty Vehicles and Alternative Fuels for Volvo Trucks, says 1.8 gallons of DME has about the same power as 1 gallon of diesel, and with some mainstreaming could be a boon to the state. It's a prototype right now, but we drive it. We have driven it about 10,000 miles, says Bio. We have partnered with a company called Oberon Fuels that produces small-scale manufacturing facilities that can produce 10,000 gallons at once. He says it's too early to say how much cheaper the production of the fuel will be compared to diesel, since not many companies are making it, but the price gap should grow once the fuel is mainstreamed. Bio says DME can be produced by agricultural waste, such as that from North Carolina's hog farms, which could partner with local trucking companies to produce and sell DME. The only problem is that regulations and a lack of mainstreaming stand in the way of this fuel hitting the market. Volvo Trucks wants to make the trucks from scratch instead of selling converter kits to companies that run their trucks on diesel, says Bio, to control quality. Volvo Trucks has little to no competition in this development, but Bio says it wouldn't hurt. We need other manufacturers to consider building this type of engine because the fuel standard has to be adjusted, says Bio, adding that DME is somewhat dry compared to diesel and would require a lubricant as well as a specific nozzle to address the flow quality problems that researchers are currently experiencing. Bio says the company hesitates to say when this fuel could be available, since many factors such as industry standards are in play, but says it will be well underway in the next few years. Eastern North Carolina gets $19 million in rural water infrastructure. Rural water systems in the eastern half of the state will receive $19 million from the U.S. Department of Agriculture Rural Development to develop and upgrade water and sewer infrastructure. It's routine, but without doing this, the quality of life in these towns is severely at risk, and their ability to grow economically and create jobs is hugely challenged, says Douglas O'Brien, USDA Deputy Undersecretary of Rural Development. This kind of infrastructure investment that the USDA is able to do is about the future of these rural communities. Sometimes it's not all that flashy, but it makes these local communities go. And in a small box next to the article, there's a some information headlined Closer Look. Central Pender Water and Sewer District, $6 million loan, $3.9 million grant. The Moores Creek Water and Sewer District, $5.2 million loan, $3.4 million grant. Town of Warrenton, $30,000 grant. Town of Eureka, $28,300 grant. Raleigh Toy Store changes name for the fourth time. The newly christened Stones Education and Toys has had multiple names over the years. Raleigh's retail shop, Stones Southern, was once a family-owned provider of audiovisual equipment for the state schools. The store later changed its name to Stones School Supply, broadening its focus. During the 70s, the store moved to Tryon Road, where the retail space had about 10,000 square feet. The Stones family store went into bankruptcy and was purchased by the Joyner family, which kept the Stones School Supply name. The store was sold to the Madison family in 2005, and the name was changed to Stones Education Superstore, so shoppers would know that not only teachers could shop there. Last year, owners David and Carol Madison moved the store to a new building at 210 Hampton Woods Lane off Chapel Hill Road, with 17,000 square feet of retail space. They decided after the first year in the new space to change the name to reflect the store's local history. The store has 20 employees. Over the years, parents have shared their feelings about the importance of having a local independent retailer of toys and games where education comes first, says Carol Madison. And finally, in a section called He Said It, a quote from Lauren Gold, Executive Director of Greater Raleigh Convention and Visitors Bureau, about IBMA World of Bluegrass attendance. Our figures estimate that there was a 5% increase from 84,000 out-of-town visitors in 2013 to 88,000 in 2014, and that's a number that everyone associated with IBMA, the local organizing committee, and Greater Raleigh's hospitality community can be proud of. And in this edition, we have a small business profile in the Triangle Business Journal concerning auto shop solutions. The headline, Niche Marketing for Auto Shops. APEC Company helped keep small businesses going during recession. And this question and answer column is written by Don Wallace. First, there's also a Closer Look box next to the article. Company, Auto Shop Solutions, Headquarters, APEC. Year founded, 2005. Number of employees, 27. Annual revenue, $3.2 million. Danny Sanchez grew up in Orange County, California, in his father's auto shop, which he and his brother took over in the 90s. Together, they grew the company and implemented strategies to become more efficient. Sanchez grew his sales knowledge and eventually branched into training and consulting auto shops, but soon found that selling services one-on-one wasn't feasible. He started building websites about 15 years ago, and when Google changed its search algorithm, he saw an opportunity. I saw the model open up to offer a new strategy for online marketing, says Sanchez. He opened Auto Shop Solutions, which handles internet marketing exclusively for auto shops. He started with 20 clients, some of which still remain, and now has more than 750 across the U.S. What sort of companies fall under this niche of auto shops? Collision, repair, tune shops, transmission shops, glass shops, and a whole separate business in parts. We've also recently gotten into restoration and performance shops. How large are your clients? They're in the $1 million to $15 million revenue range. What's the company's sales team turnover rate like? If you look back at 2013, it went from about 20% to 50%. We had to really clear house. We had a lot of the wrong people working here. Since then, there's been hardly any. Some of our folks have been here for around 4 years, and most of our employees are millennials. A lot of businesses struggled during the recession, but it doesn't sound like that was a tough time for you. Why is that? We had a lot of companies reaching out to us saying, "Help me keep my business floating." When budgets were getting cut, advertising and marketing wasn't one of them. They needed us to help, and we were sort of in the right place at the right time. Your company has expanded its current space 3 times. How is this growth funded? We have no outside funding. It's all bootstrapped, and we reinvest in our company. California has such a car-heavy culture. Why did you choose to bring your business to North Carolina? Simply to raise our kids in a better place. If you look at California schools, they are crowded. The schools in North Carolina are better. Auto Shop Solutions was a recent TBJ 2014 Best Places to Work winner. Tell me about some of the perks of working there. The staff is split into 3 teams for things like laser tag. We have hot dog days. We serve breakfast on Fridays. If someone is cold, they get a Snuggie and slippers. Every couple of months, we go out and do something fun together. One young lady is getting married, so we sponsored a bachelorette party for her with a limo. My goal is to have a fully equipped bay in here that we can use. The plan is to hire a technician maybe once a month to come in and do light services, oil changes, air filters, basic checkups. Nothing open to the public, just for us and just as a benefit. Now we turn to the People on the Move section, where the spotlight is on Mike Epperly, Director of Investigations at Risk Management Associates. Armed with a background in criminal justice and law, Mike Epperly has been tapped as Director of Investigations at Risk Management Associates. In fact, the move is actually a homecoming of sorts. Epperly served as RMA's Vice President and General Counsel before leaving to open his own law firm in Cary. He continued to remain actively involved with RMA and served as both a member of its Strategic Advisory Committee and as its attorney. Epperly rejoined RMA after its prior investigations director was hired by the North Carolina State Bar. RMA is a security consulting and investigative firm that provides an array of investigative and security-related services to its clients. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? Most people's perception of private investigators bears little resemblance to reality. While there are still some who fit the persona crafted in Hollywood, the vast majority are well-disciplined, highly educated, law-abiding professionals who entered the field after distinguished careers in law enforcement, the military, or the intelligence communities. Contrary to the prevailing view, these professionals often work with law enforcement, either by providing technical expertise or specialized services, or filling critical gaps in public services. What are some of your major goals in this position? My primary goal is to ensure that each of RMA's clients receives the level of skill, integrity, and service that has been synonymous with an RMA investigation. Education. Completed undergraduate studies in Virginia, first at New River Community College, AAS in Police Science, and later at Radford University, BS in Criminal Justice. Completed graduate work at Campbell University, JD. Last book read, It Worked for Me, In Life and Leadership by Colin Powell. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page. First, we start with the Editor's Notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, who is editor of Triangle Business Journal. The headline, it's not the money, it's the data that never sleeps. In the technology world, all the buzz in the past days has been about how consumers would be able to pay for stuff from their mobile phones. The buzz led by Apple, which released its Apple Pay feature after bagging several retailers, was followed by a consortium of retailers called Merchants Customer Exchange, getting ready to release its own system. Big name retailers such as CVS, Best Buy, Lowe's, and Southwest Airlines are all part of the consortium. For now, banks such as JPMorgan Chase and Citibank are working with retailers and tech giants to offer this service for their customers. But what got me thinking is this. Will there be a need for the traditional banks, say, 10 years down the road? Think about it. When is the last time you actually went to a bank branch? Are you doing most of your bank work online? If the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation changed the rules that said your $250,000 will be insured no matter where you park the money, would you start thinking differently? Then I read this piece in Bank Director magazine, which starts by asking whether there will be a need for traditional banks in the future when mutual fund companies can manage your IRA, mortgage shops can give you a home loan, and online banks can give you a debit card. And of course, you can pay everything from your smartphone. It is all true, and perhaps the financial services industry, as we know today, will be far different tomorrow. But if traditional banks are gone, who will make the loans? Generally, a bank's biggest line of business. Certainly, Apple, Amazon, or Google cannot do that, because if they start making loans and generating interest income with government guarantee of deposits, they will be regulated. And just by learning how Mark Zuckerberg, Tim Cook, Larry Page, and Jeff Bezos feel about government regulation, these technology companies will be catering to lawyers rather than customers should they try to poach the banking world. But as always, one thing is clear. The reason these technology companies want your banking business is not for you to park your savings with them. The reason they want to be in this transaction game is because of the data. Everyone wants to know how you spend your money in clothes, accessories, food, electronics, drugs, furnishings, everything. That can be monetized because it is personal intelligence. It is information. In the 1987 film Wall Street, leading character Gordon Gekko was sharing his wisdom with his understudy, Bud Fox, and he said, "Money never sleeps, pal." Today, however, it should be, "Data never sleeps." You get the data, you win the fight, battle, and the war. And with our remaining minutes, we'll read as much as we can of the column written by James Leah in the small business section of the Triangle Business Journal. Leah is a professor at UNC Chapel Hill and a family business speaker, author, and advisor. The title of the column, Love and Marriage and Small Business Interests. The business that my brother and I started about 10 years ago is going much better than we ever expected. We're making good money, we like what we're doing, and we like working together. It ought to be an ideal family business situation, except that our wives can't stand each other. So our families don't spend much time together, and when they do, my brother and I take a lot of flack if we start talking shop. Any ideas? And I should mention this is a question and answer column. The answer? Several family business consultants I know start problem solving with a client by doing a family psychological workup. I'm not often in favor of that approach, but in your case, some diagnostic counseling might be a good investment of time and money. To get a preliminary handle on the problem, though, consider the possibility that you and your brother might be having too good a time working together. If your wives feel excluded from that rich and happy part of your lives, maybe they're using a family feud as a way of sending you guys a message. Try letting your wives into the business side of your lives, and they might in turn let the business into the family side. My wife is on the partner track with one of this city's biggest law firms, and that's a ticket to a secure, well-paying career. But her father and uncle are urging her to come to work for the family business, a mid-sized publishing firm, so she can take over running it when they're ready to retire. She worked for the family company while she was in college and law school, but I never thought she'd seriously consider giving up law practice for it. How can I talk her out of this craziness? Before you start trying to talk your wife out of joining the family business, ask yourself why her father seems to be able to talk her into it. Her CEO's salary at a modest publishing company probably wouldn't match her take-home pay from a law partnership, so it's likely that she's responding to the family business's intrinsic, not economic, appeal. Loyalty to the family, commitment to preserving the family's business heritage, respect for her father and for what he's built, these are some of the possible family-related reasons for her interest. Or maybe she's attracted by the challenge of running a company and disenchanted with the prospect of being just another member of a big law firm. Whatever the case, try to give your wife strong support for the choice she feels she has to make, and loosen up a little. You might really get a lot of satisfaction yourself from being a member of a family business family. Mom worked side by side with Dad for almost 30 years building their little wholesale grocery business into a major regional distributor of specialty foods. She died about 6 years ago, and now Dad is planning to remarry. We kids are all for it, but his fiance wants him to sell the business and retire so they can travel together. How can the rest of the family talk him out of getting rid of the legacy that our mother helped to create? Sorry to say I told you so, but if your family had started working on a succession plan 5 or 10 years ago, you wouldn't be in this pickle. Anyway, the first step at this point is to be sure that you or someone else in your generation of the family has the commitment and the ability to take over the business your parents built and run it successfully. Your love and respect for your mother are not a substitute for the will and skill required to keep the company going. Then, if you're ready and able, go to the second step. Talk to your father about your interest in the business. Make a carefully thought out proposal to buy him out or otherwise provide financially for him and his new wife while transferring ownership of the company to the next generation. He'll probably respect your feelings and work with you on a plan. And we'll stop right there. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal, but be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.